Welcome to Western Civilization 2. This is your introductory lecture for the second part of Western Civilization here at Mars Hill. Western Civilization 2 covers the period of time from the collapse of the Roman Empire in roughly around 500 AD, and it goes all the way up until the 18th century to the movement of the Enlightenment in Europe. Basically, it will cover all the period of time from the fall of Rome until the beginning of exploration and ultimately the establishment of the United States of America. And therefore, your 11th grade year will pick up with, once again, American history. But hopefully, your study of American history will be informed by all that went before in Europe and the ancient world. So, in order to proceed with our course, I want to do just a very brief review of what we covered last year. Western Civilization 1 covers the ancient world up to about, as we said, 500 AD. And I want to just overview the main characteristics of the ancient world. This is so that we can contrast it with the medieval period of time that we're about to cover, because there's some major, major differences, and it's helpful to be able to see those differences. So what are some of the most important qualities of the ancient world? First and foremost, I'll point out paganism. The ancient world, by and large, was characterized by paganism, and paganism could be described in many ways, but for the most part, this means polytheism, many gods. You might also say that a major way of thinking about paganism is that it is not Jewish. There is no understanding, as in Judaism or Christianity, of one creator God over all creation. And so this is a major hallmark of the ancient world and the Roman Empire, even almost all the way up to the end. It was characterized by paganism. Another element of the ancient world that is going to be somewhat foreign to the New World, or to the world recovering in medieval Europe, is that it was an empire. Now, it's interesting that many Christian thinkers in the Middle Ages actually believed that empire was the ideal form of government, but it is rare that Europe ever sees an actual empire or an empire of similar size, scope, and organization as the Roman Empire. So this is another major hallmark of the ancient world, is that there was the Roman Empire, and there was Alexander's empire before that. So there were empires spread wide and broad, and we will not see such organization politically in Europe. Another very important hallmark of the ancient world was the influence of Greek philosophy. Now, this philosophy will continue among the Romans, and there are many Roman schools of philosophy, but I want to point out some of the most important elements of Greek philosophy. First, there is this notion from Plato that the created world, the physical world, the material world, is somehow bad because it is always in flux, it is always changing, and that the goal of philosophy was to see beyond the physical world to the eternal realities, the eternal truths in the mind of God if you're a Christian, but ultimately not in this material world. Greek philosophy is also marked by a focus on rationalism, on the power and the essential role of the intellect. The intellect, after all, has to discern those eternal realities. And so Greek philosophy was, you might even say, a competing form of religion. There were popular cults where the many gods were worshipped, but many, many philosophers had a very religious form of philosophy where they were aiming at escaping this world through the contemplation of eternal truth. There were also in the ancient world many, many mystery religions. I almost like to call these the rock concerts of the ancient world, although that may not be appropriate. But basically, these mystery religions were secret rites, secret cults, where individuals sought experiences that that gave them a sense of salvation, that gave them a sense of ecstasy, of escaping themselves. And these religious cults, these mystery religions, are very, very common in the ancient world. So the ancient world is characterized by a high degree of religious complexity, of religious chaos, Philosophers might sacrifice at shrines, but they also believe in their philosophy, and they might even participate in these mystery religions. But by and large, this notion in the ancient world that there are eternal realities and men sought to escape those realities through contemplation was very important. And I might also add that this took the form of understanding that there were the elite who alone could perhaps escape the physical world and understand these eternal realities, and that there were many that would never be able to do that, and therefore their worth was much less. In the Roman world, the worth of the emperor was high above the worth of a common slave. And hopefully you're thinking of the contrast in Judaism and Christianity to that value. Another hallmark of the ancient world was its cosmopolitan nature. This means it was a culture and a society that was influenced by many cultures and societies altogether. That it was a culture of cities and international trade and influence coming from many places and going to many places. Now, the Roman world, after all, was organized by this incredible, very reliable road system. And so the ancient world was united under this cosmopolitanism. And then finally, remember the term we introduced last year with Alexander the Great, the term Hellenism. Much of what we've been describing can be brought under the umbrella with the term Hellenism. And remember, Hellenism was this program that Alexander the Great developed of exporting Greek culture everywhere in order to unite the empire. He wanted the Greek language and Greek culture, like Greek sports and Greek civic institutions, like the amphitheater. He wanted all of those things to be a part of uniting his empire. And the Romans really took that over. So there's a flyby, super fast summary of the ancient world. And it's important to note that we are now going to turn the corner. Remember that in these classes, we have emphasized the major periods of world history. Remember, we sort of emphasized three main major periods. The first one is from the beginning until the fall of the Roman Empire in 500 AD, and we characterize that as the ancient world. Then there's the medieval era, or the Middle Ages, and this goes roughly from 500 up to 1500. And then from 1500 to the present is the modern world. Now, we will talk about another period that many people see beginning called postmodernism, but for now we can table that and just return to the Middle Ages. What I want to do for the first part of the year, we will be covering the Middle Ages, and what I want to do now is give sort of a glimpse of what is going on in Europe, which is the area that we'll be studying primarily, so that we can get a kind of a snapshot, just a sense of where we are and where Europe is going to be going. So the first thing to note is that the Roman Empire is no more. Now, in 476, the barbarian Odoacer came to Rome, and instead of just pillaging Rome and taking the loot and destroying stuff and going away like most barbarians had done before him, he had himself crowned king. Historians see this as a convenient marker for the end of the Roman Empire. But it's important to note that the Roman Empire had been fizzling out for many years before this. It had been shrinking. It had been increasingly invaded. It had had increasing problems internally. So by the time we get to 500 AD, the Roman Empire is gone completely. Its administration, its territories, its vast network is all gone. And not only that, the city of Rome itself had been abandoned as the capital of the Roman Empire before that. So this only contributes to the sense of collapse in the West. Remember, in 330, the capital of the empire had been moved to Constantinople, over near the Black Sea. So we are in an entirely different situation now in the West. You need to think of the West now as a backwater. That brings me to a second point about our picture of the West at 500. And that is that the Roman Empire, while we say it ends in 476 in the West, it actually continues in the East for at least another 1,000 years. So we have come to call this the Roman Empire or the Eastern Roman Empire, but we need to remember that from Constantinople, what historians now call the Byzantine Empire continued until 1453. So for almost 1,000 years, the citizens of Constantinople will call themselves Romans, think of themselves as Romans, continue many of the institutions of the Roman Empire, but they are not directly influential in the West. And so we need to keep this in mind. The Byzantine Empire will be important for many reasons. One reason is that when the Muslim kingdoms begin growing and spreading and conquering around the Mediterranean, they wind up running into the Byzantine Empire. And so the Byzantine Empire protects, in many ways, is a buffer against the Islamic invasion for Europe. Had the Byzantine Empire been there, many historians believe that Islam would have conquered all the way up to England, and Christianity would not be the religion of the West, but Islam would be. So the Byzantine Empire provides an important role there. Remember, as I said, the Byzantine Empire continues as a Christian empire. They are Greek-speaking, and they continue reading the Greek classics, both Christian classics and the pagan classics. And so they will be a very important conduit bringing those classics to the West much later on in medieval history. Now, back to Europe. So we've seen that Rome has collapsed. We've seen that the Roman Empire will continue in the East, but sort of separated from and developing on its own from Western Europe. But in Western Europe, there is one remaining sort of uniting force or uniting factor, and that is Christianity. In Europe, politically, what we're going to find is there's just this random collection of barbarian kingdoms. They are not highly organized. They are not very widespread, at least early on. And the one common cultural factor, the one thing that you might find in common in the many places you could go in Europe during this time, was Christianity. The church, we're going to find, took over many of the features of Roman organization. The bishop, for example, was sort of an imitation of regional rulers among the Romans. But at any rate, we're going to find that the church and church leaders step into the vacuum left by the Roman state and sometimes even take over some of the civic roles that the Roman government played. And so in Europe, the church winds up being, and Christianity winds up being, a very important organizer and director of life. One last thing in our picture of Europe around 500 is that we need to see, as I've said in many ways, that Europe is scattered and scared. As I've said, there's these smaller barbarian kingdoms spread everywhere. We see, after the collapse of the Roman Empire, widespread decentralization and fragmentation. What this means is that people leave the cities. Many of the grand cities of the Roman era are abandoned, overgrown. We see very little to no international trade. Regions aren't communicating and trading with one another. People are living in rural landscapes, and many people very rarely travel far at all from their home places. We're going to find that there are barbarians everywhere. What this means is there are various groups of peoples, various tribal peoples that come and wreak havoc. And so people are scared. They're hiding out. They're trying to avoid the attention of many of these conquerors. We're going to find, in fact, later that men from the north, Norse men, what later we call Vikings, are going to bring some chaos to Europe during this time. I've already said that cities are on the decline. You do not see in Europe during the early period of the Middle Ages, during the first, say, 300 years, very large cities. It is a very rural setting. And lastly, most ominously, Muslims are on their way. Now, in 500, there is no Islam. There are no Muslims. But the Prophet Muhammad will die in 632. By 732, Muslim armies will have advanced all the way through Africa, northern Africa. They will have crossed Spain and conquered most of Spain and are beginning to explore into France when they are stopped by knights in France. So another thing we need to keep in mind in 500 is on the horizon, Islam is coming. And Islam is going to play a very important role in the Middle Ages and in interaction with Christianity in Western civilization. So those three, those several things there, the Roman Empire is gone. It's continuing in the East in the form of the Byzantine Empire. Christianity is the uniting cultural and in some senses civic force in Europe. And Europe itself is scattered and scared. And ultimately, Islam is coming, and Islam is going to be a huge factor for Western civilization. So we are entering a new, very new and significant period of time called the Middle Ages. And we need to discuss that term for a minute. It was originally called the Dark Ages, and it was called the Dark Ages by people, quite frankly, who did not like Christianity. They had many reasons, they had axes to grind, but they did not like Christianity, and they therefore looked at this period of time from 500 to 1500 in a negative light, primarily because Christianity is going to be such a cultural force. You might say that in certain periods of time during the Middle Ages, everyone was a Christian nominally. Now, I want to explain what I mean by that. They are Christians culturally, or they are Christians maybe in name only, but there are really no alternatives to the Christian worldview during the Middle Ages. That doesn't mean everyone knew their Bible or everyone had a living, vibrant faith, but Christianity was the major cultural player. They had, we might say, a corner on the market. And this is nothing like it is today, and it's nothing like it was in the ancient world. And so those who were maybe looking down on Christianity in later periods came to call this time the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages. One of the ways this period of time has been described is Christendom, the Kingdom of Christ, a time when Christianity, all through Europe, regardless of where you went, you could find some of the same consistent elements of Christianity. And this is going to be a very important factor. We should also point out that, contrary to popular belief, this was a time of great advancement in learning. Science and education and learning were in many ways paused because of chaos politically, but they continued unabated. And most of the advances of periods like the Enlightenment or the Renaissance or even the scientific revolution that happened later on would have been impossible without the slow and sure developments that took place during the Middle Ages. And so we're going to try to overcome that bias against the Middle Ages. And we should add lastly, and again, as we have said on many occasions, Christianity is a very important factor during this people of time. Now we're going to find that it's a very different kind of Christianity than we're used to, or than we may be familiar with, but it is nonetheless very powerful. We're going to find many things about Christianity that we could perhaps learn from. And so that is where we are going during this period of time. So again, to review, the ancient world was highly organized as an empire. It was cosmopolitan. It was pagan. It was diverse religiously and philosophically, and it was, as we might say, liberal. But the Middle Ages, on the other hand, we're going to find, at least in the early Middle Ages, are highly decentralized. There is no vast political organization. It is characterized religiously as Christendom, the place where Christ reigns. It is very rural. There's a lot of farming. There's a lot of local culture, but not much international culture. And it is therefore, because of all these things, very, very conservative. doesn't like change, doesn't like rapid change. Now, one last thing we might mention is the role of monasticism. At the end of Western Civilization I, we discussed the emergence of monks and monasteries and the monastic movement. One of the things that is essential for understanding the Middle Ages is realizing what a significant role that monasteries played in the preservation of culture, in the advance of education, in the development of hospitals. The role of monasticism in medieval Europe cannot be emphasized enough. In this class, we will be reading the Rule of St. Benedict of Nursia, which is a guidebook for how monks should live together. And it is a very detailed and regimented ordering of all of the aspects of a monk's life. It is summarized in the Latin phrase, ora et labora, pray and work. And that is a very good description of how monks lived. And what we're going to find is that form of life, committed communities of monks devoted to worshiping God, praying to Him, and working to His glory, winds up being just an incredibly powerful, creative, generative, influential force in medieval Europe. And so one of the things we're going to come back to again and again is the role that monks play. And that will be from the beginning, from Benedict of Nursia, all the way up to monks who were at the forefront of the scientific revolution. Monks who we'll find were at the forefront of the Protestant Reformation, even. And so there is a good survey, a good overview of where we are going in this class this year. And keep in mind, we are going from the ancient world to the Middle Ages. Towards the end of the class, we will make another major transition to the modern world and bring us up to date in terms of the founding of our country and where our country has come from. So I look forward to seeing you in class, and I look forward to our next lecture.